Hello and welcome to Radio Reading Services and the Smithsonian Magazine for September 2019. I am your host, Gail Fisher. We are going to pick up and finish the article by Franz Liszt entitled The New Treasures of Pompeii. He talks about the gorgeous artworks and the grimacing corpses that the archaeologists are still uncovering. I thought it would be best to reprise the paragraph before that we finished off with last week just to get us back into sync. One floor design found in the House of Jupiter stumped archaeologists. A mosaic showed a winged half-man, half-scorpion with hair ablaze suspended over a coiled snake. As far as we knew, the figure was unknown to classical iconography, says Osana. Eventually, he identified the character as the hunter Orion, son of the sea god Neptune, during his transformation into a constellation. There is a version of the myth in which Orion announces he will kill every animal on earth, Osana explains. This angered the goddess Gaia, and she sends a scorpion to kill him. But Jupiter, god of sky and thunder, gives Orion wings, and like a butterfly leaving the chrysalis, he rises above earth, represented by the snake, into the firmament, metamorphosing into a constellation. And we pick up now from where we left off. Roman religious practices were evident at a villa called the House of the Enchanted Garden, where a shrine to the household gods, or lararium, is embedded in a chamber with a raised pool and sumptuous ornamentation. Beneath the shrine was a painting of two large snakes slithering toward an altar that held offerings of eggs and a pine cone. The blood-red walls of the garden were festooned with drawings of fanciful creatures, a wolf, a bear, an eagle, a gazelle, and a crocodile. Never before have we found such complex decoration within a space dedicated to worship inside a house, marvels Osana. One of the first really sensational discoveries was the skeleton of a man who, at first, seemed to have been decapitated by a massive flying slab of rock as he fled the eruption. The rock jutted out of the ground at an angle, with the man's torso protruding and intact from the chest down, like some romantic Wile E. Coyote. Man and rock were found at a crossroads near the first floor of a building, slightly above a thick layer of volcanic lapilli. Rather than having been beheaded, however, the 30-something figure may have taken refuge in his home in the hours after the initial explosion, leaving only when he thought the danger had passed. The archaeologist established that the man had an infected leg that caused him to limp, hampering his escape. The stone block may have been a door jamb catapulted by the force of the volcanic cloud, says Osana, but it appears that the man was killed by the lethal gases of the disaster's later stages. He and his team drew this conclusion from the missing arms, thorax, and skull, later found 3 feet below the body. Presumably, a tunnel dug under an 18th-century excavation of Pompeii had caved in, burying the open-mouthed skull, which has lots of teeth and only a few fractures. Beneath the skeleton lay a leather pouch containing an iron key, about 20 silver coins, and 2 bronze coins. If this is a house key, the man might have taken it with him, thinking there was a possibility to come back, no? The paradox of Pompeii, of course, is that its very annihilation was its salvation, and that the volcanic violence creating the enduring narrative of an entire town, frozen in time, its inhabitants baking bread, shaking hands, making love. In 1816, this seeming contradiction inspired in Goethe quote, the painful thought that so much happiness had to be erased in order to preserve such treasures, end quote. To preserve Pompey's first century treasures and decipher a history related to the larger narrative of classical antiquity, Ossana has embraced 21st century technology. We must leave for the next generation documentation that is very rich in comparison to what previous excavators left to us, he says. We can now obtain information that was once impossible to get. This is a real revolution. Satellites assess risks of flooding to the site today. Ground sensors collect data seismically, acoustically, and electro-optically. Drones produce 3D imaging of houses and document the dig's progress. CAT scans sweep away old certainties by peering into Fiorelli's thick plaster casts and drawing a clearer picture of victims and what happened to them. Laser scanning has shown, among other findings, that Pompeians had excellent teeth thanks to a fiber-rich, low-sugar diet. Through DNA analysis, we can learn age, sex, ethnicity, and even disease, Ossana says. One plaster figure long believed to be a man was revealed to be a female. The famous muleteer, a crouched male who appeared to be shielding his face from the fumes, turned out to have no arms. Was he born without them? Were they hacked off? The plaster arms were apparently sculptural improvements added to the cast in the 20th century. And Pompey's celebrated two maidens, locked in a poignant embrace, may, in fact, have been two male lovers. They were not related, said Ossana. It's a fair hypothesis. Determining family relationships will be a key objective of the genetic research. Another, assessment and assessing the diversity of Pompeii's population. With all the talk about ethnic purity, it is important to understand how mixed we are, says Ossana. This sense of proximity to our time is critical. Pompeii now seems more secure than it has since. October 23, 79 AD. Mary Beard, the Cambridge University classicist and reigning authority on Roman history, contends that the wisest course might be to stop digging for new answers. One third of the town is underground, and that is where it should stay, safe and sound for the future. Meanwhile, we can look around the other two-thirds as best we can, delaying its collapse as far as reasonable. Not far from the Regio 5 dig is a storeroom packed with just bared artifacts, pottery, paint pots, plaster moldings, the puzzle pieces of life in a city locked in an unending cycle of being lost and found. The glorious mundanity, chunked up with sex, money, and gossip, foreshadowed by the knowledge that it will end badly, like a Real Housewives reality show. Pompeii has so many similarities with our present, says Ossana. Its past is never completely in the past. And now we turn to another article. This one is entitled The Homecoming. It is written by another regular columnist for the Smithsonian, Tony Perrettet. It was one of the more cinematic funeral caravans in recent memory. In November 2017, a black vintage hearse trundled across the verdant Australian sheep country west of Sydney toward the shimmering deserts of the outback. Laid out inside was a beautiful rough-hewn casket crafted from 8,000-year-old fossilized wood. A convoy of Aboriginal elders and activists followed close behind. At every stop on the way, in sonorously named bush towns like Wagga Wagga, Narrandarra, Gundadai, the vehicle was met by jubilant crowds. In Hay, two Aboriginal men escorted the hearse into a park, where an honor guard of teenage boys carried the coffin to an ancient purification ceremony that involved cleansing it with smoking eucalyptus leaves. The rite was accompanied by traditional songs to Digaridoo, music, dancing men in body paint, and a slightly more contemporary Aussie sausage sizzle. After dark, a security guard stood vigil over the vehicle and its contents. At last, on the third morning of the 500-mile trek, the hearse turned alone onto an unpaved desert highway toward the eerie shores of Lake Mungo, which, despite its name, has been a dry moonscape for the past 16,000 years. There, a crowd of several hundred people, including Australian government officials, archaeologists, and representatives of Aboriginal groups from across the continent, fell into a reverent silence when they spotted the ghostly vehicle on the horizon kicking up orange dust. The hearse was bearing the remains of an individual who died in this isolated spot over 40,000 years ago, one of the oldest Homo sapiens ever found outside Africa. His discovery in 1974 reshaped the saga of the Australian continent and our entire view of prehistoric world migration. The skeleton of Mongo Man, as he is known, was so well preserved that scientists could establish he was about 50 years old, with his right elbow arthritic from throwing a spear all his life, and his teeth worn, possibly from stripping reeds for twine. Now he was returning home in a hearse, whose license plate read, with typical Aussie humor, Mungo 01. He would be cared for by his descendants, the Niji Yampa, Muthi Muthi, and Pa Conti people, often referred to as the three TTGs, parentheses traditional tribal groups. The elders had waited a long, long time for this to happen, says Robert Kelly, an Aboriginal heritage officer who was present. Also standing in the crowd was a white-haired geologist named Jim Bowler, who had first found the skeleton in the shifting sands and had lobbied to have it returned to the Aboriginal people. Like many indigenous groups, the tribes believe that a person's spirit is doomed to wander the earth endlessly if his remains are not laid to rest in country, and in country is in quotes, as the expression goes. Jason Kelly, a Muthi Muthi representative, was in the hearse on the last leg of the journey. It felt like a wave was washing over me, he recalls, a really peaceful feeling, like everything was in slow motion. But even as the long-awaited, deeply symbolic scene was unfolding, scientists were making appeals to the Aboriginal elders not to bury the bones, arguing that the materials are part of a universal human patrimony and too important not to be studied further. In fact, from the moment he had been discovered, Mongo Man was entangled in bitter political battles over the repatriation of ancestral remains, a kind of dispute that would echo around the world, pitting researchers against indigenous peoples as diverse as Native Americans in Washington State, the Herero in Namibia, the Ainu of Japan, and the Samu of Norway, Finland, and Sweden. Bone collecting has been a key part of Western science since the Enlightenment, yet it's now often assailed as unethical and nowhere more so than in Australia. After generations of ignoring Aboriginal appeals, the country is now a world leader in returning human remains as a form of apology for its tragic colonial history. The center of the debate is, who owns the past, says Dan Rosendahl, executive officer of the Willardron Lakes Region World Heritage Area. Science says it belongs to everybody. People tried to log on to that in Australia, but there were 1,700 generations before Europeans got here, so it's clearly not everybody's past. To better understand the growing chasm between the Western scientific worldview and the spiritual outlook of indigenous cultures, I made my own expedition around the interior of Australia, meeting Aboriginal elders, museum curators, and scientists key to the Mungo Man's strange and fascinating saga. My final goal was the hallucinogenic landscape of Lake Mungo itself, which is gaining cult status among Aussie travelers as the Rift Valley of the Pacific Rim. At its core, Aboriginal people find the Western desire to place them within human history irrelevant. Scientists trace human origins to Africa 2.5 million years ago, when the genus Homo first evolved. The species Homo sapiens emerged in East Africa 200,000 years ago and began to migrate from the continent around 60,000 years ago. Other species had likely first migrated 2 million years ago. Neanderthals evolved 400,000 years ago. The Aboriginal people believe that they have lived in Australia since it was sung into existence during the Dreamtime. The carbon dating of Mungo Man came as no surprise to them. "To us blackfellas, we've been here forever," says Daryl Papen, a Muthi Muthi archaeological field worker. That date, 42,000 years, was published as a discovery, quote unquote. That's not true. They've just put a timeline on it that white fellas can accept. My sojourn began in Australia's capital, Canberra, Down Under's version of Brasilia, an artificial city created as a gateway to the continent's vast hinterland. Today, its broad, empty highways are lined with Art Deco monuments and avant-garde structures scattered like giant Lego blocks. By its serene lake, I met Michael Pickering, director of the repatriation program at the National Museum of Australia, which oversaw Mungo Man's handover. Other indigenous communities were watching worldwide. Pickering, a soft-spoken character in his early 60s, who travels the world dealing with human remains, said proudly as we climbed into his SUV. "Most skeletons in museums are only 500 years old and in poor condition," he said, "especially if they were found in damp coastal areas, so their return arouses little scientific opposition. But Mungo Man was intact, a unique piece of prehistoric evidence." We drove from the picturesque lakefront to a prosaic, ramshackle suburb called Mitchell, in a neighborhood with warehouses selling industrial appliances in the shade of stringy eucalyptuses. Pickering stopped at a secure gate and punched in a code to open it. Only after more codes, special keys, and signing a logbook could we enter a cavernous museum storage facility crowded with relics, like a theater prop room. In archival drawers were convict leg irons from the early 1800s, jars of antique marsupial specimens, copper plate etchings of native plants made by naturalists on Captain James Cook's 1770 expedition. Our goal was a room within the warehouse, the repatriation unit. "It's not pretty, but very functional," Pickering said as he unlocked the door. The space is austere and solemn, with beige walls and icy climate control. Neatly stacked in a back room were some 300 cardboard boxes, some as small as shoeboxes, each one containing Aboriginal bones. Many were retrieved from Canberra's now-defunct Institute of Anatomy, which exhibited skeletons to the public from the 1930s to 1984. Some had been sent by private Australians, sometimes in cookie tins or crates. Others came from museums in the United States, Britain, and Europe, all of which have held Aboriginal skeletons for study or display. We had 3,000 individuals, all Indigenous, in the 80s, Pickering marveled. Rooms full of bones, locating the Aboriginal communities to return them to, involved serious detective work. Many of the skeletons were mixed up, their labels faded or eaten by silverfish, and their origins were only traced through century-old correspondence and fading ledgers. The unit's centerpiece is a table where skeletons are laid out for tribal elders who wrap the remains in kangaroo skin or wafer-thin paper bark to take back to country. But not all of them want to handle the remains, Pickering said, often asking staff to do it instead. It can be a harrowing experience for the elders, says Heritage Officer Robert Kelly, who has worked in repatriation since 2003. To see the skulls of their ancestors with serial numbers written on them, holes drilled for DNA tests, wires that were used to display mounds. They break down. They start crying when they see these things. Although Mungo Man had never been displayed or seriously damaged by intrusive scientific tests, emotions ran high in the lab on the morning of November 14, 2017, when his bones were carefully placed in the casket here for his funeral procession to the west. The first ceremony was held, of all places, in the storage facility's parking lot near the vintage hearse, its doors marked with the red, black, and yellow of the Aboriginal flag. Warren Clark, an elder from the Pakanti tribal group, surveyed the bare asphalt expanse during his speech. "This is not home for me. It is not home for our ancestors either," he said. "And I am sure their spirits won't rest until they are buried back on our land. Our people have had enough. It's time for them to go home." Lake Mungo's remoteness is central to its appeal to travelers. "Only people who are really interested will get there," says Rosendahl of the World Heritage Office. He wasn't exaggerating. The journey still qualifies as an outback adventure. "My jumping-off point was the isolated mining outpost of Broken Hill, which I reached in a small propeller plane packed with engineers. At first, the town felt like a time warp. An enormous slag heap looms as a reminder of its heyday in the early 1900s as the world's largest producer of lead, zinc, and silver. Monstrous trucks carried livestock rumble down the main street. Buildings, old butcher shops, trade union clubs, barbers, sport Wild West-style verandas with ornate iron lace. But the retro illusion was punctured as soon as I checked into the Palace Hotel, a Victorian pub that was taken over in the 1970s by an Italian immigrant who fancied himself a painter and used every interior surface as a canvas, including the ceilings. The hotel pub was a set for the 1994 film The Adventures of Priscilla, the Queen of the Desert, about a trio of drag queens touring the outback. Ever since, it has been a pilgrimage site for gay men hosting weekly transvestite shows. Today, the crusty mine workers in flannel shirts and broad-rimmed hats nursing their beers at the bar, not amicably, to the technicolor blur of buffed men steaming by in sparkly sequins, wigs, and feathers. My guide was a U.S.-raised artist named Clark Barrett, who moved to Broken Hill 40 years ago so he could fall off the map. "I wanted to live somewhere I could see the rotation of the earth," he explained, as we hit the road in a 4x4. He still camps in the desert for weeks at a time, painting and observing the sky and the stars. The rotation of the earth makes my day is his favorite joke. Outside Broken Hill, the unpaved highway sliced without a single curve across the lonely existential landscape, which was given a degree of notoriety by another Aussie movie, Mad Max 2. Mile after mile of flat scrub was interrupted only by the occasional tree rising like a stark sculpture, a mailbox fashioned out of an 8-gallon drum, or a silent township with little more than a gas station. We were closely monitoring the weather. Rain had fallen the night before and threatened to turn the road into a slippery morass. This was Mystic Australia, and far from lifeless. Mobs of kangaroos bounded by, along with strutting emus. Shingleback lizards with shiny black scales resembling medieval armor and garish blue tongues waddled into the road. The native bird life was raucous, brilliantly colored, and poetically named. Lousy jacks, Mogul parrots, rosellas, wily wagtails, and lorikeets. By the time we reached the turnoff at Mungo National Park, the bars on our cell phones were down to zero. We screeched to a halt before the only accommodation, a desert lodge with lonely cabins arranged in a circle. The only sound was the wind moaning through the pine trees. At night, beneath the brilliant swath of the Milky Way, total silence fell. The sense of entering another era was palpable and mildly unnerving. We will end for this week at this point and pick it up next week and read more about Mungo Man. On behalf of Radio Reading Services, this has been Gail Fisher. Thank you so much for listening today and welcoming us into your homes. We wish you a great day and a wonderful week ahead.